We did it. I still can't believe we got this project done so fast and so well.
When I'm in New York,
I'm in Chicago,
and I'm in LA. But
we're making it happen in Miro.
Together.
Our best work just happens faster on Miro's collaborative online whiteboard. No more scheduling meeting after meeting for work that could happen
from anywhere, whether it's getting design feedback here,
mapping timelines here,
or brainstorming next steps here. It all just happens on the Miro board.
Exactly. And it's nice not having to wait an entire day to get sign-off from this guy.
Hey! Well, it is true.
See how Miro users save up to 80 hours every year by meeting less and doing more. Get on board at Miro.com. The first three boards are free forever. That's Miro.com.
Hello and thanks for joining us on the Boys in the Band podcast. I'm Richie Gallagher.
And I'm Peter Smith. And on this week's podcast, we speak to Chris Sester, the drummer from Jet. So maybe you should have said good day, Rich, our first Australian band on the podcast.
Yeah, long time coming. Good day indeed. and Chris told us all about the Aussie rock scene, or perhaps the lack of it when they were first starting out in the early 2000s, and how bands like The Vines were a big game changer, drawing the attention of the music industry to Australia, which worked out pretty well for Jet, didn't it?
Yeah, right place, right time. And it also helped that they'd written what would become a global smash hit in Are You Gonna Be My Girl? But as Chris explains, it could have been very different, but for an intervention by the guitarist Cameron Muncey.
One of the many contributions that Cam made to the song, but probably the most important one. And honestly, I really don't even think that song would have been as successful if not for this moment. But we had worked it up, you know, and I had obviously the beat of the Motown beat, and then it was pretty popping. It sounded fun, and everybody was like, "Yeah, this sounds like," because we wanted to make music that girls could dance to, because we had noticed that rock bands, like as I was explaining before, had just sort of become almost like Creed Nirvana copyists. And it was just shitty, and girls didn't like it. And every time we'd go to a rock show, it would just be dudes. So Are You Gonna Be My Girl is a really good reflection of what we were trying to do, which was get girls back into the game and, like, you know, having music you could dance to. And so we got it worked up to a point where the chorus hook was, she's just like every other girl. And then Cam was like, after, you know, a week or something, he was like, it's just a bit negative, you know, just like every other girl. Why don't we change it to Are You Gonna Be My Girl? And that was it, basically. Well, the song was already written, really, but that changed everything, I think. And I don't think that song could have gone as far as it went if he hadn't have made that suggestion, because it was too negative.
Yeah, definitely a good idea to swap that lyric out, I think. Rich, I love it when musicians hum a bit of one of their tunes. I don't know why, when he broke into a bit of that beat, I really loved it. Didn't Baz from the Fratellis, I think, did something similar with Chelsea Dagger, just these iconic little riffs. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I totally get where you come from. It's really cool just to hear these musicians actually just refer back to a little segment of one of their big tunes. And obviously it really demonstrates their musicianship. They just absolutely nail it.
Let's break into it. Yeah. Maybe we need to do a compilation podcast, a special of just people humming tunes. Maybe that's the way to go.
Yeah, he definitely did it much better than I could anyway. But Chris and the boys from Jet hadn't even left Australia by the time they started the band, and then all of a sudden they blew up all around the world. Their songs were absolutely everywhere at that time, and Chris tells us about those tours with the likes of Oasis and Kings of Leon and Rolling Stones, and an outrageous all-expenses-paid stay in Barbados. But then also how it was a bit of a bumpy ride after that through their next couple of albums, after the debut Get Born.
Yeah, it certainly can describe it as a bumpy ride, I think. Jet currently not together at the moment, but Chris is very excited about his new project, Mystic Knights of Amnesia, a band named by Noel Gallagher, no less. They've got their album coming out next year with some superstar guests on it as well, so find out a bit more about that as well. But here he is, Chris Sester from Jet on the Boys in the Band podcast.
This week on the Boys in the Band podcast, we're delighted to be joined by Chris Sester from Jet. How are you doing, Chris?
Well, wonderful. How are you, fellas?
Really good.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks, Chris. Good to have you on. And Chris, we always start the podcast with three quick fire questions, which we call the sound check. And the first one is always, where are you? So whereabouts in the world are you today?
I'm in West Hollywood in Los Angeles. Very nice. And yes, it's a sunny, you're in the UK, right? So I would say probably about 21 degrees Celsius. Blue skies, typical LA weather.
Yeah, okay. Very currently at 9 degrees. Thanks, Chris. And it's getting colder by the day. So
you know what? I'll be honest though, you know, like I've really missed the weather, you know. There's no bloody weather here. It's just hot and sunny every freaking day, like lizard weather, you know? Like, and it's awesome when you've been, you know, Australia, because a lot of people don't understand Australia, where I'm from, has weather. And, you know, particularly down south where I'm from in Melbourne. And and so I've been here now almost 20 years. And I'll tell you what, yeah, I miss the seasons, you know, like, time passes in a very strange way when you don't have seasons, because like there's nothing kind of to mark it off, to base it, you know. You don't have your winter period where you got a reflection and all that sort of shit. It's just hot and sunny every day.
Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't sound too bad to me, Chris.
Curry sounds great if you're living in England. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking of that tomorrow morning when I'm scraping the ice off the car, you know. Nice one. So next up in the sound check, Chris, we always ask what our guests are listening to at the moment. So any particular artists you're into right now?
Oh man, I normally would probably have a really good answer for you, but honestly this week I've been so busy working on new music, I really know. I've been focusing really just on my own stuff, and by that I mean, you know, 18 hours a day. So I'm not just using that as an excuse, but I haven't really been doing anything except like listening to my own songs hundreds and hundreds of times over and over again, as is the process of, you know, making a record. Yeah, I was trying to think recently. No, I'm just self-obsessed. I got nothing else to report.
tell us a bit about this project then, Chris.
The band Jet broke up for the first time in around 2010, and my Jet's keyboard player, Louis Macklin, and I had become really good friends. He's not actually in Jet, but he played at keys for us for a long, long time. And so we became super close. And when the band broke up, when Jet broke up in 2010, we started writing songs together. Because, you know, it's like if you're, you know, if that's what you do and you're a musician, it's kind of hard to turn the tap off. So we just started writing together, and that was a long time ago. And we were called Damn Dogs for a while. And actually, it's funny, while we were looking for our name, I hit Noel Gallagher up, and I was like, I asked him if he had any ideas. And one of his ideas was Mystic Nights of Amnesia. And me and Louis both just thought that was fucking mental. So he said, oh, you know, thanks. That's crazy. And then, you know, so we did this Damn Dogs thing for a little while, and it was pretty cool. It was like sort of doom disco kind of like, you know, pretty bold, like damn, like more like dark electronic rock kind of, I don't know, it sounds weird, doesn't it? But anyway, we did that for a little while, and then two of the members left the band. One of them was the bass player in Jet, and so we were like, I don't know if we ever really felt totally comfortable anyway. So Louis and I continued on, and we said, well, you know, it's two other guys. No, it's just us now. So we probably need a new name. And then Louis, out of nowhere, remembered Mystic Nights of Amnesia. So I text Noel again, and I didn't say anything. I just said, Mystic Nights of Amnesia, ? And he goes, holy shit, that's amazing. Where did you get that name? So I was like, oh, I don't know if he was fucking with me, if he remembered it or not, or if he just was like, wow, that's incredible. So it's called Mystic Nights of Amnesia. Sorry, long story. It started off with Louis and I, and it sort of evolved now to include two other guys. And I am it's really, I'm pleased to announce, it's almost fucking impossible to describe how it sounds. I can tell you for sure that some of our influences would be like the kind of stranger elements of pop, maybe like 10cc or Bee Gees. It's got quite like a bit of a soul vibe at times, it's quite intricate in that 10cc way and exploratory in the same sense. So it's really hard to describe. It's a lot of fun. It's usually upbeat. Our first song, our first release is going to be, you know, I think it's like 9.5 minutes long, but it's kind of like four songs in one. There's not a boring moment in it. It's not like a prog thing, although I would say that there probably are some prog elements to Mystic Nights of Amnesia, as there are in 10cc. That's probably the closest thing that I can think of, because it's just, if you think of 10cc, it's kind of off the wall, yeah. You know, in that it just sort of bounces around like crazy, and but it still makes it point and keeps your attention. I'm not allowed to announce yet the guests that we have on the record, but we have a couple of guests that are pretty mind-blowing. You know, I'm talking about a couple of artists that have sold over 100 million albums.
Wow.
And these are people that, it's funny how they happened, is like, you know, like my friend will do a solo or something, and then my manager will go, hey, that sounds like so-and-so, you should, you know, we should ask him. And then we get in touch with them and they're like, absolutely, I love this. And I'm sorry, I can't like go into a thing, but I'm not allowed to until we have to ask their management for permission first. And so we're in the process of doing that. It's what I've been up to.
Cool.
I just got a good sleep in this morning for the first time in a good 10 days. So I'm feeling back. I'm back to the land of the living, because it's like being in a submarine when you go into sessions like that, that are so intense and you can't, you know, it's hard to relax. So I'm feeling good.
When do we get to hear the end product then?
Oh, that's a good question. Because it's become, and this was never really the intention, but because it's become such a sort of collaborative record, there are a lot of elements that I've never really had to deal with before, having just only been in Jet. You know, things about permission and managers, and you know, believe it or not, some of these guys, like, they have to go through a few different rings in order to get their music released on other records that aren't their own. So it's hard to answer, and it is a lot. I imagine this is what it's like for a rapper, because, you know, when they make records, they're using samples and, to get clearance. That's the word I've been looking for. It's like, you know, so it's hard to answer, but what month are we? What month is it? November. I would say early next year. There'll be something, and I really hope so, because one of the artists' contract says that if I don't release this song, he's going to release it. So the clock is ticking.
Cool. Well, Chris, let's go back to, wind the clock back now. Melbourne, Australia, how Jet started off. Now, I think you might be the first Aussie band that we've had on the podcast so far. So tell us a little bit then, what was influencing you guys when you were starting out, and what the scene was like in Australia for bands starting out in the early 2000s.
Yeah, not very good. The scene wasn't very good, which is, you know, I think sort of reflected in a lot of our music, especially songs like Roll Over DJ, which we all fucking hate, by the way. Like, we all hate that. It's funny because it wasn't about electronic music and, you know, disco. It was more about the culture that was alive at the time when we were just starting to go out a lot, you know, as 18-19 year olds, 17-18, whatever, you know, that it just being that it was a lot of just electronic music, and it was just seemed, if you were into rock and roll and we had all grown up on it, that it was just dead, completely dead at the time. The only real sort of things that were happening in rock and roll were things like were the remnants of grunge, the grunge era, such as, you know, Creed and Nickelback, and like, you know, you had bands like Limp Bizkit, I suppose, and there was nothing that sort of even sounded close to what we grew up loving. And so when we started to get into like a rehearsal space and started like learning to write songs, then quite obviously the things that we were doing were reflective of all the records that we were listening to. And I think that's pretty easy to figure out when you listen to a Jet record. And you know, and then along came the Strokes, and you know, just sort of that whole, that, well, actually, you know, I want to say this because I often say, you know, when I've had a few drinks with my friends, and I don't know if I've ever said it before publicly, but it, but I really think that the Dandy Warhols are owed a little bit more of a debt for starting that whole, that trend of the early 2000s, because that 13 Tales from a Bohemia record with Get Off and Bohemian Like You and were really great. And also Mars Volta too, or At the Drive-In, Mars Volta. Yeah. And then the Strokes came along and changed the whole thing. And all of a sudden, bands like us, who had been sort of previously, I guess you could say, I don't know, slaving away kind of privately, because we didn't know what to do. We didn't think that there was going to, anyone would be interested in what we were doing. Suddenly it got exciting to be young and in a band, and then the Vines came up, and that really was the game changer for Jet, because the Vines came through, and then all of a sudden the music industry can often be quite sheepish, and all of a sudden everybody was looking in Australia for the next hot thing, because the Vines had just got on the cover of Rolling Stone, etc. And so it was drab. The music scene was quite slow and dead, and it just suddenly exploded. I would say in that order of At the Drive-In, Dandy Warhols, to the Strokes. We'll get to this because I know you have another question for me, but that's sort of, and then it became exciting, and we started playing. The first gig we ever played, there was four people there, and I think they were just accidentally there. They were just like, you know, having a couple of pints, and they were probably like, oh Jesus, live music, bloody hell. And then very quickly it all changed. And when once the Vines got on the cover of Rolling Stone, things started heating up really quickly. And we had a residency at a pub called the Duke of Windsor. And it was kind of like a bit like a movie, like 10 people the first week and then 40. And then by the end of the month, there were people like outside the windows trying to look in. It was all very exciting. And then all the world's music industry descended on us, and they all came out to Australia, which was an interesting point too, because our manager, he was a little different, and they were offering us money, come out and do a showcase in London, come out and do a showcase in LA, and he was like, not like very Australian kind of guy. If you want to see this band, then they're going to be playing at this pub on this date, and then they all came. So it was a mad night. I think the NME said something funny, like if you put a bomb under that pub that night, the entire music industry would have exploded because everyone was there. So things happened pretty quickly for us once we decided to step out of the shadows, you know? By that time, clearly, as reflected in the interest in our band, the rock and roll scene had really started to pick up, and all of a sudden, everywhere you looked, everybody had a floppy fringe and a pair of Converse.
Yeah, so we're talking around the sort of the Dirty Sweet EP times. Did that come a little bit later? That was 2002, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And we recorded that at a place called Birdland Studios, which was over the road from the Duke of Windsor pub where we had that residency I was just talking about. So it was all walking distance. Pretty small. I mean, Melbourne, you know, Australia's pretty small. I mean, Australia is not small. Huge, but population-wise, you know, and especially, you know, the rock and roll business wise, very small. So there's only a few studios. So we did the Dirty Sweet EP and we pressed it into vinyl. I remember sitting at Cam's kitchen table and like numbering them, hand numbering them personally. So that's what it was like. And I think Cam's girlfriend had made a bunch of Jet like panties that were really awesome. They were like, they were really like, they had strings on them. They were really cool. And I remember we sent the head of the CEO of Atlantic Records, it was a woman, Sylvia Roan, a pair of them after we signed the record. Yeah, it's pretty funny. So that's right. Yeah, Dirty Sweet EP 2002. I think most of those songs, if not all of them, ended up on Get Born. We re-recorded them in LA.
Yeah, I think they did. And obviously Get Born came out in 2003. And that just seems like, you know, you've talked about the snowball effect when you're having the residency, but the snowball effect of the band really in those 2 years, you released that debut album, you planned loads of shows. I mean, it must have just been an incredible ride for you at that time.
Oh, man, yeah. Like, I hate to use well-worn phrases, but yes, it was definitely a bit of a blur. You got to remember, like I'd never even left Australia, so it was absolutely wild to us. Like we were in LA, like, you know, and this is pretty. I mean, I got a lot of stories, but this is a good example of just how kind of quickly things had gotten crazy from driving a forklift to, you know, we were rehearsing at this place. In LA called Cold Rehearsal. And, you know, we were doing pre-production for the record. So we were there with Dave Sardi, who actually coincidentally mixed 13 Tales from Over Bohemia, which is why we worked with him, because we just were like, well, that Andy Warhol's record sounds amazing. So we found out who did it, and that was Dave. And we were in the production, in doing pre-production with him at Cole, and like, and you know it's like those rehearsal places, you can hear other bands, and at one point our bass player goes, oh, who, to the owner, who's that shitty Kiss cover band? And then the guy goes, that's Kiss. and we didn't believe him, and then, you know, because we're like 21, we're like, what, no way. And then sure enough, like Peter Criss walks out 10 minutes later and gets into a blacked out benzo and drives away. So, you know, that's a kind of a good example of like how quickly things had become really insane for us. And that was before we even put out the records. So then, you know, you're talking about, you know, playing sold out shows for 2 years and meeting your heroes and going on tour with Oasis and like, you know, going on tour with the Rolling Stones and, headlining festivals and just like, wow, it all happens so quickly that I suppose, you know, in a way that probably I'm sure is one of the reasons why it kind of fell apart for us so quickly, because it just sort of came in such a like meteoric way that we weren't really ready for it, how it would feel to be in the middle of the hurricane kind of thing. So yeah, very exciting. Lots of happy times, lots of long nights, lots of celebrating.
You mentioned Dave Sardi there. You know, you went out to LA to, you know, to record your debut album. You know, not every band ends up, you know, going all the way across to LA where you are now to record their debut. And we've had bands on this podcast, we've worked with him before as well. So how much of an influence was he on actually the sound that you actually ended up laying down?
That's a good question. It's a good question right now, because I'm sitting on this wealth of material right now, and I'm like, who should I get to mix this record? I'm like, shit, well, Dave Sardi is pretty fucking good. And to be fair, to be totally honest, structurally the songs were written before we came into LA. Honestly, there were a couple of things that we did. I remember at one point he said, oh, Cold Hard Bitch, like, you know, you repeat that chorus too many times. So we chopped one of them off, or like, you know, we might have shortened a couple of things. We might have changed a couple of BPMs, you know, like I think probably, oh no, I would say absolutely, to be fair, like we probably bumped most of them up. You know, Are You Gonna Be My Girl included, Cold Hard Bitch included, Look What You've Done included, all of them. You know, oh, that it's too slow. And now if I listen to the Dirty Sweet EP ever do that, it's very rare. But if I heard Cold Hard Bitch like maybe 6 months ago, and I was just like, holy shit, it's like a nursery rhyme tempo compared to what we ended up with. So he definitely influenced the BPMs, but sound wise, oh, I don't know if there's anyone better, at least in rock and roll and vintage, like, no, not vintage, like analog sounds, you know, he doesn't fuck around with digital things. And I think that's really evident in his on all the records he made, you know, the Oasis record, the Don't Believe the Truth record, the Wolf Mother record that was huge. I mean, God, he's done so many records I can't even think right now, but definitely impactful. I mean, all you have to do is listen to Dirty Sweet EP next to Get Born to see like the impact that Dave Sardi had on the sound of the record. And anything he does. I mean, I was looking at Instagram yesterday and I noticed like that he just did a record with Ozzy Osbourne. And I think, you know, that right now, more than ever, he's the guy that you want to go to if you have something that's real and it's played by real musicians and not just cut up in fucking Logic, you know, or Pro Tools. And so he absolutely impacted the sound of the record. And I think one of the key things about his sound is that you can turn it up to absolutely full blast and it doesn't hurt your ears. You know, whereas if you think, I'm trying to think of an example, I like a great example might be sort of a Raw Power by the Iggy and the Stooges, where it's amazing and it sounds great and it's got like a really good energy in about it and it's crackle, pop, fizz and all that. But you turn it up to like 7 and you're like, and it's like the high end's getting in your ears. Dave has a way of making a record sound massive and in your face without pissing you off, like without like annoying your ears, you know. And that's actually a really, really difficult and challenging skill, and something that he's probably the best at that that I can think of all the big guys and all the big names out there.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting side to the process, I think, which, you know, as fans or people listening to the track, you know, you just don't think about it. I think you think about the band who've written the song and performing the song, and you know, that's sort of those important details that go on behind the scenes, you know, sometimes get missed, but clearly so important.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, not to forget too that the other impact that Dave had on the record was that we were babies when we went to LA. We really didn't, all we knew how to do was write a song and like, you know, grow our hair long and like wear tight t-shirts. Like some of the clothes some of the clothes that we wore, fucking hell, makes me laugh. but you know, he told me a few things that I never forgot, that I actually still, to be honest with you, I still use to this very day. You know, I don't know how interesting this is to people, but like, for example, when I got in the studio, a proper studio, we recorded Get Born at Sunset Sound in LA, which is another legendary place. And, you know, I was in there just doing my thing, banging away. And he came out and he was like, look, you're just hitting them too hard. You know, if you just hit them a bit more softly and hit them properly in the middle, and you know, and come and listen to the difference, you know, because you have like $8,000 compressors in there, and the way that they work is you get more out of them if you don't hit them. So like he taught me lessons when I was 20 that I still use to this very day. Mm-hmm. And also just funny things, like I remember driving in the car, you taking us to lunch one day, and I said, oh, what's your favorite record? You know, Marilyn Manson, Red Hot Chili Peppers, so many records that you ever worked on. And he goes, and this is pretty typical of him, he goes, none, I fucking hate them all. And I was like, what? Get fucked. What are you talking about? And he's like, Trust me, you'll see. You'll hate yours too once this is over. And he was right, because the process of making a record is, you know, very, it's laborious. It's quite repetitive, and it's not nowhere near as exciting as it might seem from the outside. I'll be honest, like I quite enjoy the process of singing a vocal, because you never get to hear your voice, and it's such a personal thing, your own voice. and you never get to hear your own voice sound as good as it does in those incredible places with incredible mm-hmm. engineers like Dave Sardi and whatnot. And so, you know, you get to hear it for the first time, and it's like that's a fun part of the process. But the rest of it is, it's almost like stacking boxes. You know, mm-hmm. you're just kind of like, all right, do we have that? Do that again 20 more times. Haven't got that yet. Speed that up, slow that down, you know.
Yeah, yeah, the hard work. But obviously it pays off in the end, and especially when you come up with songs like "Oh, You Gotta Be My Girl." And let's talk about that one just for a little bit, Chris, because obviously a huge song over here, huge song everywhere. Tell us a little bit about how that one came together, how that formed for you guys, and just the impact, the global impact of that song and what it did for you.
Well, that song was written by my brother Nick Sester and our guitar player Cameron Monsey. So I wrote the line "Big Black Boots." Never got a credit. Fuckers. My brother Nick and predominantly my brother Nick and Cam, a little also wrote that song. And that was just a riff that Nick had written by himself. And I can say that I think one of the like many contributions that Cam made to the song, but probably the most important one. And honestly, I really don't even think that song would have been as successful if not for this moment. But we had worked it up, you know, and I had the beat of the Motown beat, and then it was pretty poppin', and it sounded fun, and everybody was like, yeah, this sounds like, because we wanted to make music that girls could dance to, because we had noticed that rock bands, like as I was explaining before, had just sort of become almost like Creed Nirvana copyists, and it was just shitty, and girls didn't like it. And every time we'd go to a rock show, it would just be dudes. So "Are You Gonna Be My Girl" is a really good reflection of what we were trying to do, which was get girls back into the game, and like, you know, having music you could dance to. And so we got it worked up to a point where the chorus hook was, she's just like every other girl. And then Cam was like, after, you know, a week or something, he was like, it's just a bit negative, you know, just like every other girl. Why don't we change it to "Are You Gonna Be My Girl?" And that was it, basically. Well, the song was already written, really, but that changed everything, I think. And I don't think that song could have gone as far as it went if he hadn't have made that suggestion, because it was too negative. Anyway, so the impact that had was, I mean, I guess you probably already know that was like a huge hit, and it changed our lives forever. You know, in America, it was the first song used on the Apple iPod campaign, you know, which was a trip in itself, because iPods at the time were brand new technology. So the idea that you could have all of your music on this little thing was a brand new concept at the time. So it was exciting technology. It was an exciting song. The tempo was right. The message was right. The beat was fucking perfect, obviously. It just went nuts from that point. And actually, Get Born had come out and was kind of languishing around the bottom 100 of the charts. And, you know, we'd gotten a pretty big record deal. So we were like pretty nervous about what was happening. And then it all changed when the iPod commercial came along. And I believe in the UK, if I remember correctly, there was a phone thing. it was on a big phone commercial, and so that helped it pop off. But I mean, it sort of, it doesn't really matter what it was, what like medium it was, because it's one of those things, you know, all of a sudden you're everywhere and everybody wants a piece of it. So it's not really, it's chicken and egg, really. And so that song changed the whole game. And then once people were aware of us, I think we were on tour with Kings of Leon at the time the record broke, and they, at that point in time, they hadn't broken America yet, and we just exploded, and we were back. We were supporting them, so that was a bit awkward. But it just went on from there, you know. And then once people sort of notice you, then you know that's the sort of knock-on effect with the rest of the songs. You know, Cold Hard Bitch was really big then after that, and then top. And then Look What You've Done was another top 40 hit in America. And, you know, just things snowballed after that. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really did snowball. Those songs were just everywhere that year and the year after those. Did you have time to sort of stop and reflect at the time to think that, oh, my God, you know, this is really taken off beyond our wildest dreams? You know, we're massive success all around the world. You've literally just conquered the whole world in such a short time. You know, it must have been pretty surreal to have that success.
Yeah, absolutely. And you would probably, I'm sure you would find a different answer from the other three fellas. But, you know, speaking honestly, like it happened so fast that I don't think we didn't have time to reflect, one. And two, you know, when I was 22 years old, like, you know, when you're 22 years old, you think you can conquer the world and you think you can do anything. You don't realize how hard it is to achieve things. And so incredibly, it happened on my first roll of the dice for me personally, and didn't have time to reflect, and also thought, yeah, that's about right. Like, you know,
yeah.
And that's what I wanted, and, you know, and I got it. And it's like incredible. It's incredible for your self-belief, and it has had a knock-on effect for me my entire life, you know. So, you know, there were definitely times, there were moments, like glimpses, when we would go back into the past. Like, you know, there was a couple of crazy moments, you know. Obviously, when we went on tour with Oasis, it was pretty great, you know, playing in Times Square, and it felt like every time we went on a late night TV show, it was a moment too, because we had all grown up watching Letterman and Conan. We did Letterman like three or four times, and so those were always big moments. New York TV, walking in the building, and it was after 9/11, so it was all a big serious drama, getting in the elevator and going up there and all that sort of shit. But those moments were moments where we would look around at each other and go, this is pretty crazy. Like, you know, but, you know, in the aftermath, like, for example, when we finally, it's a hard question to answer, because I'll give you an example. Maybe that's the best way. When towards the end of Get Born, we were finally exhausted. Like, you know, we told our managers at the beginning, we'll play any fucking show. We'll do anything. You know, and they were like, are you sure? And we're like, oh, yeah, whatever. We can do anything. Rah. And then so they made us do everything. And finally we were exhausted, and then GQ magazine wanted to do some kind of shoot with us in Barbados. And we were like, we were just too fucked. We were like, no, it's where everybody's fucking exhausted. We have to go and have a break. We have to start thinking about the next record. This is crazy. And then, but they kept coming back. And finally, you know, this was over like a 3-week period. Finally, we said, all right, well, if you fly all of our girlfriends out first class and, you know, and you get a bunch of instruments there for us and recording equipment so that we're not just standing there like dickheads getting our photos taken, and then we can start work, then all right. And we just thought, but they did it. And I mean, it must have cost them a fortune, but it wasn't even a cover. It was like a spread. And that's a really good example, like of just how crazy things had gotten. And that was at the end of Get Born. And like, those are the kind of things that had become normal by that point, you know. And the fact that we were like, yeah, I'll tell you what, fly our girlfriends out first class. So that's like, to think of what I was doing 2 years earlier.
Wow, yeah.
It's incredible. So, yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. Good stuff, Chris. Well, we'll take a quick break there, but we'll get more of the Jet story in part two.
Hi, this is Chris from Jet. You're listening to the Boys in the Band podcast.
We did it. I still can't believe we got this project done so fast and so well.
When I'm in New York,
I'm in Chicago,
and I'm in LA, but
we're making it happen in Miro.
Together.
Our best work just happens faster on Miro's collaborative online whiteboard. No more scheduling meeting after meeting for work that could happen
from anywhere, whether it's getting design feedback here,
mapping timelines here,
or brainstorming next steps here. It all just happens on the Miro board.
Exactly. And it's nice not having to wait an entire day to get sign-off from this guy.
Hey! Well, it is true.
See how Miro users save up to 80 hours every year by meeting less and doing more. Get on board at Miro.com. The first three boards are free forever. That's Miro.com.
You're listening to the Boys in the Band podcast. For more noughties nostalgia, check out our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram pages, and make sure you hit subscribe to the podcast for more interviews like this. Welcome back to the Boys in the Band podcast, where we're with Chris Sester from Jet. And we were talking part one all about the whirlwind and global success of the debut album Get Born that came out in 2003. And you mentioned the fatigue at the end of that cycle, Chris, but being also keen to start work on the second album. So just tell us a story of that follow-up record, Shine On, which came out 3 years after the debut in 2006.
Well, it started off with the GQ magazine spread, really, and then which we used as an opportunity to start showing each other songs that we'd been working up in the background while we were on tour of Get Born. Like, we started thinking about it, and then, well, it's a long story. The best way I can explain it is by saying that, yeah, by the time it came around to Shine On, the state of the record business had really, really declined. And it had been going in that direction for a long time, but it had gotten to a point where, you know, Atlantic, well, for example, we signed to Elektra with Get Born, and then they got taken over by Atlantic, and everything just got smaller and smaller. And so we ended up on Atlantic with a bunch of people we didn't know. Only a couple of key people came with us, kept their jobs. And so the pressure started to build, and that really is the best way to describe how it felt coming into that second record. And the pressure was incredible. And because we had been so successful, you know, it wasn't like an indie hit. It was like our big record. So, you know, Atlantic had started to put financial expectations on the success of Shine On. And, you know, they fought us at every turn as well. So creatively, artistically, that was really quite difficult. You know, and then in between Get Born and Shine On, mine and Nick's father passed away, which it's hard to describe the impact that that had on everybody, especially now, it was so long ago. But looking back, you know, it was incredible. He was a very charismatic guy, very well loved. And, you know, and that goes for Cam as well, who spent a lot of time in mine and Nick's house growing up. So it just like rocked us so hard. And I personally felt the need to keep going and, you know, and keep working. And we turned down a really fantastic Glastonbury spot, for example, because, you know, I don't think that Nick was really in a place that he felt like good enough or happy enough to go on touring. And so he didn't want to do it. I did. That caused a lot of friction between the two of us. you know, for example, me saying, well, why the hell wouldn't you want to do it? Like, you know, he would want that. He would want us to, blah, blah. So things got off to a really rocky start. And then I think right in the, and we'd all started making money too, don't forget. So then all of a sudden it wasn't, it was just so fucking complicated. And the thing is, you know, Jet was a very uncomplicated thing. And when it started, and it was really, and I think Nick had a couple of really good quotes about this, but you know, for Jet, like the show would get in the way of the party. Like, you know, we were just partying the whole time, and then it would be like, oh shit, I go on stage in 20 minutes, you know, and then so the show would interrupt the good times, and then the show would be fun, and then we'd go back to the good times. And so when that's the way you operate and that's your structure, then some really serious things happen. Like, you know, my Nick's father passing away, and then the financial expectation of the success of the second album, and everybody's rich now, and everybody's drinking more, and everybody's doing more, everything. Then that's a sort of a good way to describe the scene. Welcome to Shine On. And then everything just kind of went, everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. Well, not wrong. I mean, you know, Dave had it right in the middle of Shine On. Dave had his firstborn, and we had to hold up for 2 weeks, and it was just a stop start affair. I remember after, this is a good one, after when we were in Barbados, things were going really well. We wrote a couple of really good songs up out there. None of them made it onto the album, which is just an absolute classic example, because we were just so happy with these songs. We loved them. And I called our manager from this mansion that the GQ had rented. It's like the kind of place where they put Russian diplomats and shit, you know. I think the Clintons holiday there. There's butlers and shit. It was mental. Like, you just ring a bell and someone brings you a rum and coke. It was like, you know, good times. You'd be out on the beach and guys would just roll up on jet skis. All right, who wants this, who wants that? And that's how it started. So I called my manager and I said, like, we're having the best time here. Everybody's getting along. We're writing really good stuff and it's just paradise. Let's stay here and do the thing. And then my manager was like, oh, that's a really bad idea, Chris. You know, it's like $50,000 a week or something, whatever, I can't remember, to stay in that house, or maybe more. No, it wouldn't have been much more. And I was like, okay, but like, we're making money, so who gives a shit? Like, let's just do it. Who cares? We're having fun. Let's stay here and make a record. It'd be amazing. It'd be a great story too. And, you know, no, that's really, Chris, like, just like, forget about that. It's not a good idea. All right. Hung up the phone. I remember because it was one of those phones with a curly wire, because it was like Barbados, you know. Oh, and I needed a hard line to get through. So and then the next day I was like, I'm not giving up on this. And I called my manager again and I was like, man, you don't understand. If you could see this place and see how well everything's going, you would understand. No, talk me out of it again. Eventually I lost. The band also obviously were chiming in and they were like, eh, that's a bit crazy. Like, you know, so that's what, like 200 grand for a month or something. So we went on a break and then, all right, manager came up with a new idea to write songs. And that was that we would go to a place called Longview Farm in Massachusetts, which is a really cool studio, but it was the middle of winter and we got snowed in. Mark like had to go to hospital, hypothermia, because he smoked a joint this big, smoked the whole thing and then stuck his head in the snow and had to go to hospital. And we were just fucking miserable there. It was so cold, we couldn't leave. Nobody had any ideas. It sucked. And so we went from paradise to hell. And then we went on another break. And then, all right, we did two writing sessions in LA. So by the time you put together all of the flying around in first class and dicking around and like stopping for this and stopping for that. You know, I mean, I don't even want to say, to be honest, it's an embarrassing number how expensive the album was. But let me just say it was a lot more than $200,000. Like disgustingly a lot more. So yeah, so we ended up with this album that we really were really proud of. We eventually we found a way to sort of hone in and get the best out of what we were going through. And you know, hence why it had a black album jacket, and we didn't want to have any like Jet on it and stuff, and it was a little bit of an ode to our father, and the record company were just like rolling their eyes basically, because you know they wanted everyone to know who it was and that we were back and that they wanted it to sell what they said Chili Peppers numbers. Can you believe that they have a phrase for massive albums and it's called Chili Peppers numbers? And that's really funny because that's my favorite quote, is that Nick Cave's quote about the Chili Peppers. Have you ever heard that? Oh, no. I don't want to say it. You just can look it up after. but anyway, yeah, so that's what it was like. And I'm really proud of the album, to be honest with you. If I'm ever listening to a Jet song or album, it's usually that one. Or the third one. I never listened to Get Born. And when I landed a couple of these guests on my new project, I had this moment where I was like, damn, that's really crazy, you know, that person wants to do this. And I wondered why, like, what would make someone like that say, and then I thought, well, shit, obviously, Get Born. I never even think about it. And so I put on Get Born and listened to it, and I was like, oh, yeah, it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. It's not a bad record. you just never do that. You don't really go back. Dave was right when he told me when I was 21, you're just never going to fucking listen to this ever again.
Yeah.
And he was right.
Amazing. So if you look back on that time now with all your experience and, you know, obviously the craft that you've got now as well, and then sort of taking that into Shaka Rock as well for the third album, because I know you guys had a bit of a break before that and obviously stopped in 2012, not long after that as well. I guess people would say, you know, perhaps see cracks in that appearing around the time of that second album, which led into the third album. But was there anything you could have done like differently to change that? Or was it just the fact that, you know, those circumstances, the speed of your rise, the money that was getting thrown around, it just made for a storm that was just so, well, just went the way it did?
Well, that's a really good question. And the truth is, yeah, probably if there's one thing that could have changed it, who knows? You never can predict these things. But if there was one thing that we could have done differently, it probably would have been to listen to each other a little bit more, rather than to just adamantly follow our own intuition, you know, our personal intuition or ambition, you know. As I was explaining before, Nick, you know, didn't want to do Glastonbury. And when it came to doing Shine On, I think he still wasn't really ready to go. But I was like, fuck, that's crazy. Like we're having this moment. We've got to capitalize on that. We should put out a record. What else are we going to do? What the fuck? I mean, you know, I don't have any other education, you know, and if we wait too long and, you know, then no one will give a shit and et cetera. So there was a lot of arguments about that sort of thing. So my answer to that question would be, yeah, we could have maybe tried to listen to each other, and perhaps we jumped in too soon. And if we had have just sort of given each other a little bit more space, particularly Nick and I, if I'm honest, then maybe things would have been different. You know, if Nick had a little bit more time, then maybe it all would have felt a little bit different when we got back together. But as I just explained, you know, like the money flying around and all of the pressure that was on the band really sort of fed into it. So, yeah, if we had have sort of waited maybe and just sort of been patient and just told everyone to fucking chill out, I mean, we still had the run of the contract and everything like that. So, you know, we could have fought a little bit harder to just sort of wait and be a little bit more patient. But no, that's what I think. That's the only thing that I think could have changed anything. But yeah, so then from there, things just kind of just spiraled. Like personally, everything just got completely chaotic. Nick and I really started to not get along. I mean, I can't speak for them officially, but I can speak for myself, and I was definitely getting out of control, like just drinking and just, you know, carrying on. So, and I think a lot of that had to do with my father passing away, but also the pressure of the what was going on with the band, but mostly it was personal.
When the band did finally decide to call it a day, sort of after that third record, was that you know, a mutual decision? Was that a tough decision to come to? Was it something that you just felt at the time was right?
It was a shocking thing, because even though you know, the second album was nowhere near as big as Get Born, it was still pretty big, you know, especially if you consider now record sales now, like. Yeah. It'd have been a smash if it was out right now, like just numbers wise. But you know, obviously the whole game's different now with Spotify and everything. But no, it was a real surprise, because, you know, I think by that point we were all like grown up to a point where we are all very much aware that in any career you have ups and downs, and that it doesn't necessarily always go according to plan. And so even though things hadn't been going as well, you know, we were still pretty huge. We could still pull some really big numbers, and we were still making a lot of money playing live shows. And, you know, and in certain places, you know, even Shaka Rock, like we had like some big hits, you know, especially obviously in Australia, where we've always had like, you know, a hometown advantage, if you like. But in weird countries, you know, like not weird countries, in countries we wouldn't have suspected, like Switzerland, Shaka Rock was massive there. It was so bizarre. Like, you know, Japan, and then just some strange parts, you know, unexpected parts of Europe. And so there, we still, you know, we still had an incredible career, and so we got to Australia and we played this huge tour, and my brother called me for lunch one day, and I was shocked by that. I'm like, we never hang out if it's not show day. So we went and had lunch, and he just said, yeah, I don't want to do this anymore. And it just blew me back. Because even though now looking back, it makes total sense. I can see exactly why he wanted to do it. But at the time, I was in shock and I couldn't believe it. I got up after lunch and just walked down the street, and I was like in a daze, like, how could he not want to be in this band, you know? Because like I said, things were still like, you know, still going really, really well, even though the record sales didn't reflect that. And it doesn't really matter when you've got some giant hits, you know. You just got to keep going, and eventually you'll come through with another record, which is hopefully what is going to happen for me shortly. You never know. You just never know. It's a really, you roll the dice. So it was a shock to me when he decided to do that. And it's always a shock, because it wasn't the last time.
What brought you guys back together in 2017 then, after sort of that situation?
I think that was the Bruce Springsteen thing. We, you know, I'd get a phone call once every 3 or 4 weeks from my manager saying, you know, you've been invited to do this or that, or, you know, Jet's been invited on this festival and whatever. And I'd be like, yep, sounds great, you know. And it would never happen, because Nick would say no. And then finally that call happened, and I was like, yeah, same thing. And then I was like, good luck with Nick, haha. And then he said, no, he's already said yes. So I was like, what? So we we went on that tour. I don't know why. That's a question for him. I never really asked him, like, what made you change your mind? Maybe he was getting, like all of us, you know, if you've ever performed on stage in front of thousands of people, it's very addicting. And maybe he just got sick of sitting at home. I got no idea. But he said yes. I always say yes because I love that shit. And I'm like, I'll do it. I'll do it in 10 minutes. If there's something happening, I'll go. But we're very, very different in that regard. You know, he's a lot more private and he likes to take his time doing things. And that's part of our problem creatively.
And you followed that up with the Get Born 15th anniversary tour as well, that brought you back over to these shores in 2018. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah.
and that's the last that we saw you over here as Jet. Is that the end of the Jet story, do you think? Or do we think in the 20th anniversary, 25th anniversary, things might be coming back around?
I don't really want to talk about that. I don't really know, to be honest with you. It's kind of out of my hands. I certainly would, like I just said, you know, I would love to, but at this point in time, it doesn't seem like really a possibility. Never say never, obviously. And look, the truth is, you know, both times that we broke up previously, I was told, you know, that it was never going to happen again. And then it does happen. So I don't know. And things really, really ended quite badly on that tour. So I don't really want to, that's what I mean about not talking about it. I don't really go into details about it because it's all quite personal and it wasn't pretty, we haven't spoken for a couple of years, Nick and I, but we're brothers and, you know, I'm sure, well, I hope there's still love there somewhere and we will, you know, one day figure it all out. And hopefully, I mean, I would love to tour with Jet again. And I'm always positive about it. I'm always like, you know, just thinking positively, maybe, who knows, one day. But for now, I'm concentrating on my record and, I'm making the kind of music that I don't think Jet could even possibly make, like not in a good or bad way, just as an impossible way. Yeah. Because I've had an opportunity to collaborate with people who do things that they would never think of doing. And that's, you know, the same goes for them. Like they are going to have ideas that other people would never have. So I'm really enjoying that. And for the first time in my post-Jet career, I really actually think that I have a really good shot at having something that I can, you know, really, that can really be a successful vehicle for my, like, creative output. I'm really excited about it. It's wearing me out. It's bloody hard. It's hard to do it at 40. Yeah. Harder than when you're 21, and definitely to get to get people's attention. But I feel like I'm figuring out how to do that as well. So it's definitely been an interesting couple of years, and I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, awesome. Sounds really exciting. Yeah, I can't wait to hear this stuff. Mystic Knights of Amnesia. Yeah, early next year, you said, hopefully. So,
hopefully it might bring you over to these shores touring with that band, right?
Oh, absolutely. Because we've got to get Noel to come out.
Yeah.
I just saw his face on the Zootons.
Working with the Zootons.
Oh, actually, funnily enough, Zootons are one of the, I can say they're one of the collaborators because they're like buddies of mine. So the other guys are guys who who have to like ask their fucking, you know, manager and their agent, their label. But I'm pretty close with those guys, Sean and Dave and Abby, and Boyan. And so I see that they're making a record right now with Nile Rodgers, yeah. which is really exciting. Really excited to hear that record. But anyway,
yeah, cool.
Answer your question. Yeah, I would love to get over there and see my friends and show everybody what we've got going on.
Cool. Can't wait to see it. Absolutely, Chris. Now, Chris, we finish up with three quick questions at the end as well. And well, we'll call it the encore, and we'll start the encore. Well, we've mentioned a few times Noel Gallagher. You obviously toured with Oasis. What's your best tour story with those guys? that you can tell us.
Oh, good. Yeah, that I can tell you. Shit. well, I mean, my favorite night of that tour was probably, oh, God, there was a few. Madison Square Garden was great. I remember Nolan, Liam's mum, Peggy, came out for that one. And it was just absolute madness backstage. I don't know. They like to drink Guinness. So there was quite a few cans of that floating around. But no, probably, sorry. My favorite was the Boulder. When we played in Boulder in Colorado, it was Liam's birthday. And Noel had a couple of, I don't know what you're allowed to, what do you call them? Small.
Shorter people, shall we say?
Shorter folks coming in with cakes and like just champagne. it was a wild night. In fact, there's one of their DVDs. The gatefold of it is like the small people and Oasis and Kasabian were on that tour as well. Jesus Christ, I feel like I just lost a year of my life just thinking about it. I mean, there really isn't one in particular. I mean, Noel's so funny. You know, he on the daily, he would just say something hilarious. I think, like, I believe Liam said to God. I mean, if Liam said to Cam once, like, walked in, Cam was in catering, getting something to eat, and Liam goes, how you doing, Cam? And he was like, yeah, not bad. And he just goes, not fucking good enough, and walks out. That's the kind of tour it was. Anyway, sorry, that was a long answer.
Oh, that's awesome. Great stuff. Next up in the encore, Chris, can you pick out the best gig that you've ever played?
Barrowlands is pretty amazing. It's really hard to answer that question, you know. As we said earlier, we played so many shows. Barrowlands is always great. The first Barrowlands show we played was probably the most memorable because we had never experienced a Scottish audience before. And as you guys are probably aware, they're pretty nuts. Like they go, there's another level that they go to over there with the throwing the drinks in the air and all that sort of wild shit. Like we walked off drenched in beer and we thought, like, did they hate us? But we could see that they were loving it. And like, so we didn't really understand. And someone from the record company was there and they're like, no, don't understand. That's a great sign. And I'm like, good, because I need a fucking shower. Barrowlands, probably our first Barrowlands show, which would have been around 2004.
Nice. And the final question of the pod, Chris, what's the song you're proudest of?
Oh, good question. And I'm not just saying this as a sell-on, but they're all the ones that I've just been working on. They're the best things I've ever done because you just know more and you're a bit more confident in your decisions. But of the Jet material, I would say probably 17, which is the song that I wrote off Shaka Rock, which was quite a big hit in Australia, actually. And I think, you know, I think that if circumstances were different and the music, you know, because the music industry is quite sheepish and, you know, and they tend to just sort of follow each other around and whatever's popular, everyone jumps on that sort of bandwagon. But if we sort of had have done the right thing throughout China, I think 17 would have been a huge song everywhere. I'm really proud of it. I think lyrically it's strong and melodically, it's very memorable. So I would say 17.
That's a great choice. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. It's been, you know, an absolute thrill to talk to you all about the full Jet story from beginning to end and the exciting project that you're been beavering away on in the past few weeks, especially with Mystic Knights of Amnesia. We'll look forward to hearing that in the new year. But yeah, thanks very much for joining us.
Welcome, fellas. Have a good, what is it over there? Evening.
Nice one. Cheers.
Nice one.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.